Poet Mark Doty has always been attentive to the details of life and our environment, both interior and exterior, natural or man-made.
Poets are always walking around with antennae in every direction, right? And we don't even understand half the signals we're picking up. But I think we devote ourselves to receptivity, seeing what will the world tell me today?
Find out how Mark Doty expresses what he discovers in both poetry and prose on New Letters on the Air, a production of New Letters Magazine at the University of Missouri, Kansas City. I'm Angela Elam. From his first poetry book in 1987 called Turtle Swan to his 2013 compendium of creatures, A Swarm, A Flock, A Host, Mark Doty has more than a dozen books of poetry, memoir, and essays that have picked up numerous awards, including the Lambda Literary Prize twice for his poetry books Atlantis and Source, and the Penn Martha Albrand Award for his first memoir, Heaven's Coast. In 2008, he won the National Book Award for his new and selected poems, Fire to Fire. So we look forward to his 2020 book, What is the Grass? Walt Whitman and My Life, due out in mid-April for National Poetry Month. A New York City resident, Doty talks about the devastation of the AIDS epidemic in this 2013 interview after Rockhurst University's Midwest Poet Series reading, when I asked about the difficulty of choosing from decades of poetry to assemble his collection, Fire to Fire.
Putting together a selected poems is a very daunting project. It's like you're having a party and you only have so many invitations. So you cannot invite everybody you love to this party. And when you make a selected poems, you are putting some of your children, or whatever you want to call them, into the spotlight for a number of years, because it's very likely that the books will be probably going out of print, or at least much less available. So that means you're sending some of your poems into the shadows and you're putting some of them in the spotlight. How do you make these decisions? I don't think you just say, well, the best poems, because I don't know what the best poems are. I took poems that have mattered to readers. I took poems that matter to me. I wanted it to be a readable book from beginning to end, not just a reference book. So that meant variety in tone, in length, in the ways in which a poem was constructed. And then I just blundered through. And, you know, and I thought I probably did it all wrong, but I did it. And I swear, you know, the book came out. I carried it with me to give the first reading afterwards, and the poem I most wanted to read wasn't in it. I left it out.
Oh,
I mean, why'd
no.
you do that for?
That was going to be one of my questions. Was there something that you left
of
out?
Of course. There's several somethings that I missed, but you just can't put everything in there. It was, therefore, awfully nice to win the National Book Award, because I thought, well, I guess I didn't screw it up so badly. You know, this was a validation, because, you know, that's a prize where you have a jury of your fellow poets. To be singled out in that way is a thrill that I never imagined experiencing.
You know, talking about how you put the new and selected poems together, it was almost like it was a piece of architecture. You know,
yes.
You're building a house in a way and trying to inhabit the different rooms.
And you're telling a story about your life. These are the poems, the images, the concerns that seem to me most representative. They're arranged in such a way that there is a kind of narrative. The poems are divided by books in which they originally appeared, but I rearrange them, their order, inside the books. And you're really deciding how you want to be seen in some way, and that's a little weird.
That would be hard, too, because you have to get outside of yourself.
So. You do.
I thought I would get you to read the poem, A Display of Mackerel.
This is a poem that I always like to tell people a little bit about its beginnings. I was living in Provincetown, Massachusetts, at the end of Cape Cod, and you had to go a long ways in those days to get to a good grocery store. You had to drive 25 miles. So I went to Orleans to go shopping. I was entranced by the mackerel on ice in the fish market. And I had 25 miles on the way home to think about them. So I found myself beginning to describe them before I'd ever made it out of the car. This is called The Display of Mackerel. They lie in parallel rows, on ice, head to tail, each a foot of luminosity barred with black bands, which divide the scale's radiant sections like seams of lead in a Tiffany window. Iridescent, watery prismatics. Think abalone, the wildly rainbowed mirror of a soap bubble sphere. Think sun on gasoline. Splendor and splendor. And not a one in any way distinguished from the other. nothing about them of individuality. Instead, they're all exact expressions of the one soul, each a perfect fulfillment of heaven's template, mackerel essence. As if, after a lifetime arriving at this enameling, the jewelers made uncountable examples, each as intricate in its oily fabulation as the one before. Suppose we could iridesce, like these, and lose ourselves entirely in the universe of shimmer. Would you want to be yourself only, unduplicatable, doomed to be lost? They'd prefer, plainly, to be flashing participants, multitudinous. Even now, they seem to be bolting forward, heedless of stasis. They don't care they're dead and nearly frozen, just as, presumably, they didn't care that they were living. All for all, the rainbowed school and its acres of brilliant classrooms in which no verb is singular, or everyone is. How happy they seem, even on ice, to be together, selfless, which is the price of gleaming.
A Display of Mackerel, the poem by Mark Doty, originally included in his book Atlantis, but is also in the collection Fire to Fire, which won the National Book Award in 2008. You take something like a mackerel and make it into a thing of beauty, which I think you're known for that.
Well, I love intricate surfaces. I love trying to capture something of the flash and complexity and character of the visual world. But, you know, a poem always has to do more than that. And so in describing the mackerel, I was paying attention to what is it about this that matters. It's when I got to the bit about nothing about them of individuality, and I realized they're all exactly the same, that I was starting to touch upon an obsessive subject of mine, which has to do with collectivity and individuality. What does it mean to be one mackerel? You know, do mackerel have, you know, romantic souls? Do they live for their collective position in the tribe? That sounds like a jest, and to some degree it is. But if you read the whole volume, Atlantis, from which this poem comes, you would know that these are poems largely set in Provincetown, Massachusetts, during the crisis days of the AIDS epidemic. Provincetown was a little town that was severely hard hit by AIDS because it had been a gay and lesbian resort for many, many years. And it was a place where people came for a refuge. And I saw people in my community disappear right and left. 3,000 year-round residents, a funeral a week during the early 90s. You know, it was like living in wartime. And then there were people who would be at death's door, and then you'd see them the next week in the A&P, you know, looking at the frozen foods. It was such a strange sense of the contingency and fragility of living. And so that kind of meditation, I hope, is pressurizing this poem.
I don't think I grabbed all that as I read it, but, you know, now that you say it, I see it as a metaphor.
What's the lovely thing about poems is that you don't have to,
know
what I was thinking about or what was at stake for me. I think readers come to poems and they, if we're lucky, inhabit them with their own inner lives. So the poem can be a sort of meeting space between the writer and the reader, where I'm bringing my interiority to bear and you're bringing yours, and we make something collaborative and perhaps always a little different in the middle.
Yeah. Did you actually sit down and write the poem before you figured out what attracted you to it?
I started. And in fact, I would say this is true of the vast majority of poems that I write. Something is compelling me, but I don't know what it is until the poem has been unpacked, investigated. If I know what I want to say about something, I'm far less likely to ever write the poem about it. But the trigger, the little visual stimulus that pulls your sleeve and says, look at me, is usually the tip of the iceberg of metaphor. I knew that there was something for me in those fish if I would just go on exploring. Now, sometimes the poem fails because I never figure out what the something is, you know, and it winds up in a drawer, and I'll come back and try again in a while. But it seems like my work is to find in the given vehicles for what's most important to me.
You're making poetry, but it's also an act of discovery for you, and hopefully for your reader as well.
I hope so. Yeah. I think the energy of discovery is contagious. If we are willing to go looking and see what kind of meaning the world might offer us today, who knows where it might carry you.
I wondered if we could read Fire to Fire. Do you think it would be too long?
Not at all.
Okay.
This is also a little more like a notebook, you know, a palm-like, say, a display of mackerel is a very wrought, contained thing. And this one is a little bit more like, here's this, and think about that. You
know? Yeah.
This began when I grew one summer these really beautiful sunflowers, the kind that are bronze and russet and dark, bloody, bloody red. And I came home one day, and suddenly two of the sunflowers seemed to fly up into the sky. And you'll see why in the opening of this poem. It's called Fire to Fire. All smolder and ox blood, these flower heads, flames of August, fierce bronze or murky rose, petals concluded in gold. And as if fire called its double down, the paired goldfinches come swerving quick on the branching towers, so the blooms sway with the heft of hungers, indistinguishable now from the blossoms. Tannic yellow or rust, a single brassy streak at each mid-petal, colluding in a bull's-eye ring, copper circle around the seed hoard, flashing like a solar flare. You can't finish looking. They rear and wave in Pentecostal variety. You might as well be tracing flames. Maybe nothing gold can stay separate. Not feather, flower, fire. My work's to say what signals here, but Lord, I cannot see a single thing. If I were a sunflower, I would be the branching kind. My many faces held out in all directions, all attention, awake to any golden incident descending, drinking in the world with my myriads of heads, I'd be my looking. And this section quotes Walt Whitman. Painters have painted their swarming groups in the center figure of all, from the head of the center figure spreading a nimbus of gold-colored light. But I paint myriads of heads, but paint no head without its nimbus of gold-colored light. They're rattling August clothes, faces a swirl of hours, coil in the seed unwound at last to these shag faces bent over the ruining garden. Warm evening, vertical and gold. Stalk of the body, glistening hairs radiating out from the curled and lifted leaves paired along the stalk, pattern plunging toward the center like the line of the thighs. Paul said when the neighbor's puppy ran across the street into traffic because it wanted to see our dogs, it looked like a little flame. Nothing gold can stand apart from any other. The sunflowers are trafficked by birds, open to bees in twilight, implicated, alert. Fire longs to meet itself flaring. Longing wants a multiplicity of faces, branching and branching out. Heads, mouths, eyes, wishing always to double their own heat. Which is why the void can make nothing lasting. The fuse resides in the yellow candling up, signaling, and the concomitant yellow hurrying down to meet it. And nothing that is fixed can call its double down from heaven. The gold calls to the gold in the arc and rub, calls to itself in the other, which is why the coronated seed head flashes the finches down.
That's the poem Fire to Fire, which is actually the title poem of the new and selected poems by Mark Doty, winner of the 2008 National Book Award. This is New Letters on the Air. So much of your work is a celebration of life and the details that surround us. From the mackerel to the flowers, you just have such an attention to detail. But there's an elegiac quality to your work, and I think you find a good balance between paying tribute and celebrating. And I think that's sometimes hard to do, to celebrate things in the passing of them.
When I was starting out as a poet, I thought that in order to be taken seriously, I needed to write earnest poems. It didn't occur to me to put a joke in a poem or a gesture of wit. And over time, I began to think, well, the poems that I like best are the ones where there's a sense that as much of the writer's personality is operative as possible, so that the mind that makes a joke or that makes a humorous connection or that turns then that tone into something darker and more troubling. That's a kind of evidence of human presence and of awareness working on the world. It's very moving to me. I feel like the goal for us as poets is to just figure out how to get as much of ourselves on the page as possible.
Yeah.
And there are parts that we all want to leave out. Some people think I have many angry poems. I think I've written very few angry poems. So that's an aspect of myself that's been harder for me to incorporate. The political self, the social self, sometimes that can be a struggle. But yeah. I think I've got the comedian in there now. he's getting his due. The comedian, the singer, the diva.
Yeah. Well, so much of your work has had to deal with being a gay man in America, and you mentioned the AIDS crisis. You had a partner for all those years, Wally, who died, and this was when you realized that you couldn't write poetry, and that's when you wrote that particular memoir. Because you've written three memoirs now, or is it four?
I've written three memoirs
and a couple of prose books
that are something else, you know.
Can you talk a little bit about why you choose to write something in prose versus why you turn to poetry?
I think it's often the same material or the same common core, and I'm walking around it in a different way. In the case of Heaven's Coast, which was my first memoir, I felt that poetry, which was what I had been doing since I was 16 years old, to know what I thought and felt, had cracked for me. I could not, in the state of new grief, when you know, it's an oceanic state. One feeling pours into another. You sort of don't know where you are half the time. I couldn't make something as limited and stable as a poem because I would have had to leave too much out, you know? And I needed something that would be a big arena in which to operate and bring many elements of experience to bear. A poem places feeling and language in a very sharp, focused light. Because it's so compressed, you know, and because it has lines which hold a little bit of sound and a meaning in a tight space. Prose is, the lighting is more relaxed, you know, there's more room to spread out. And so it's easier to comment and build context and to tell background stories. So I started out just writing an essay about living in grief, and it was so satisfying to do, and it helped me so much to concentrate and to have a project, you know. Then I wrote another one, and then there were three essays, and then I realized I was writing chapters, and I was writing a book simply about observing what it is to live in grief. And it was very natural to talk about a walk on the beach with the dogs that day, which might lead me to remember a story from my past with Wally, which might lead me to what I had been reading, which might lead to a metaphysical question, to another story. There was a kind of natural hybridity. And I think this is a kind of memoir that's really interesting to me, that it's a way of stitching together a container for experience out of many forms. So I had this hunger to make something bigger, to construct a larger architecture. And it's a pleasure to do that because a little bit in chapter one can be echoed in chapter 10 in a new light, and it can come back again, and things take on more dimensions of meaning as they are repeated and reshaped. So it can be a very satisfying form and also a very indefinite form. I don't think we have a fixed template at all for what a memoir is, and that's thrilling.
Yeah.
Dog Years, but my most recent one has some stories about dogs, but it also has some sort of natural history writing. It has some travel writing. There are two Emily Dickinson poems in full and a discussion of the poems. There are all kinds of things are in there. And that pleases me that one might use many kinds of subgenres, really, in order to construct an inquiry into, in that case, love and time. What does it mean that we love creatures who will not live as long as we do? And why do we invest in that? And what does it bring to us?
Well, you mentioned your dogs. Arden and Beau turn up in Dog Years, a memoir. But you also have quite a few poems that have to do with your dogs. And I thought I would have you read one of those. This one has to do kind of with time and passing as well. It's called The Stairs.
Oh, sure. Absolutely. Yeah. I used to live in a house in Provincetown, which was one of those very early 19th century houses or late 18th century houses where the ship's carpenters had done lots of the building. So the stairways were very steep and designed to occupy very little space. And my old, increasingly arthritic dog had to confront those stairs. The stairs. Back when Arden could still climb our stairs, sharply pitched, turning near the top, the sort old carpenters modeled on the stairways of ships, he'd follow Paul up to his study, shadow me up for socks or a clean shirt. Even if I only went upstairs for a minute, he'd wheeze and labor on the narrow steps and arrive out of breath, proud of himself, and collapse on the rug before coming down again. Up and down. All day. At night, he wanted to sleep in his bed at the foot of ours. Wanted it so badly, the pressure intensified the climb, what with the tall risers and his gimpy hind legs. So he cried and fussed and tried, gave up and went away, came back and tried again. If he couldn't make it on his own, I'd get up and help him, lifting his front paws and setting them into place, then my hands under his hips. The stairwell would smell of his anxiety. Bodily, familiar, slightly acid. Once he could no longer climb something so awkward, it was as if he'd forgotten he ever wanted to. He'd wedge his muzzle into a hole he'd made in the sliding screen door, push it to the left, and sleep all night in the garden, on the gravel, beneath the spread of a Montauk daisy. Why can't I hold on to that image? The dreamer beneath black leaves and a spatter of summer stars. Indelible, that old man scent. The fear that makes the stairway steeper.
The Stairs, from the book School of the Arts, a 2005 publication, and it's also included in the new and selected poems by Mark Doty called Fire to Fire. You're listening right now to New Letters on the Air.
And obviously, you know, that's a poem in which I'm thinking about my own body over time and the way that we are burdened by fear. How do we live in time with some kind of grace, some kind of acceptance? It's a subject that worries many of the poems in that particular book. There's one right next to it about the late Stanley Kunitz, which is sort of the opposite poem. It's about Stanley enjoying time and change in the garden. Is that a way that we could imagine ourselves moving into the later parts of our lives?
The dogs can help you reminisce about that as well, you know, that you see through them even though they're animals. You have a very special connection with them.
Oh, they're such focal points. For one thing, they are a kind of theater of mortality because they do travel through time so much faster than we do. So you see them young and growing very quickly and arriving at their adulthood and then fading out in the course of however many years, 10, 15. For another, they can provide you, as so many aspects of experience do, with metaphors, you know, a place to think about what's going on with you. I mean, that poem is more about me than it is about Arden.
You also are very open to all of the world out there, the beings in the world, not just human beings, but all of our animal friends and insects and everything. So it did not surprise me to see that you have a new book that's a bestiary.
Yeah, this is a collaboration with a terrific painter named Darren Waterston. And he had the idea of producing a bestiary. Darren showed me some drawings. I showed him some lines. And then we just went back and forth and back and forth. And the thing happened sort of effortlessly. We produced about a 60-page poem, but that's because there's like one line on every page.
Right, it's very got all this artwork. It's very intricately done. It's gorgeous.
I thought it was remarkable. Darren did these beautiful, I think they're called rotogravures. They'll be for sale in a portfolio of a limited edition for about $5,000 a piece. But
whoa.
Then we got a German art publisher, and they produce many, many museum catalogs. And so they gave Darren's visual work to their book designer. And she took the poem, his visuals of animals, and she made her own vital, brilliant collage out of it. So they're silhouetted images of everything from frogs to deer, turtles, and the poem is spread out among them. And I think it's one of the most attractive visual objects I've ever seen.
That doesn't cost $5,000?
The version that Presto is publishing costs $16. And
okay.
It's beautiful. It's bound in green cloth. And here are these lovely pages spilling over with animal life.
and is published as a compendium of creatures in a book with artwork by Darren Waterston. And I thought I might have you read a little bit of the beginning.
I'll be happy to.
It's called A Swarm, a Flock, a Host.
Screech owls tumble down the night stairway, and summer rises like a great swelling cloud bank. Yellow jackets digging deeper into their underground globe, swirling and swirling down there in a buzzing, terrible sphere of threat. The cardinals nail a brilliant point to the morning's argument. The turkeys lament their fate all day, but no one listens. The appetite of the ticks swells with the mounting hours. Midday snake hot on a shelf of stone. No frog talk till dusk. But the grasshoppers can't contain their happiness, which causes the tight machinery of their bodies to spring forward further, higher, more ambitious, though the goats lie down and pant in the hot shade. The woodpecker wears on his forehead a bit of the original flame, so that he might not forget the conflagration in which the world began, and the long, slow, only to our eyes, burning, whereby it is perpetually consumed. Hail to fire, says the outrageous tale of the mandrel. Even in darkness, flame is hidden, reads the subtle tipping, outlining the wing of the red-winged blackbird. The very domestic dog, who would not know how to live in the city were it not for the men who love him and fill his bowl and guide him at the intersection so that he doesn't walk into the heedless traffic, stops still when the ambulance comes, rushing up the street toward him, and tenses his body, lifts his head a little, and begins to howl quietly, matching the pitch of the siren exactly. When I found the deer's body at the back of the garden, where it had sunk into the earth beneath the wire fence, and from it gushed a great fountain of maggots, horrifying, sickening, that fecundity, and yet it was the stream pouring back into the world. Movement from something to nothing and back again. Descent that passed in blind pain and then swelled out into the unstoppable current of the new. All the world's dense and disparate populations filter that music through the singular registers of their voices. But it's the same terrifying song. Now there's a presumption. If you grant these erratic aerialists character, think the monarchs noble in their dashing for the stored sunlight of sugar, well, who are you to condemn the appetites of tinier things? Cowbirds and catbirds comb the garden, tossing aside leaves, eyeing the stalks, hunger piled upon hunger. Well, says my friend, you have to be a good animal before you can be a saint.
That's just the beginning of the 2013 book-length poem, A Swarm, a Flock, a Host, a compendium of creatures by Mark Doty. He also read from his National Book Award-winning selected poems called Fire to Fire after Rockhurst University's 2013 Midwest Poet Series. His 2020 book, What is the Grass? Walt Whitman in My Life, is due out mid-April for National Poetry Month, when he'll also appear on the PBS series Poetry in America. You can hear a 1999 interview with earlier poetry by Mark Doty in our website's audio archives at newletters.org. Follow us on Facebook, Tumblr, Twitter, and Instagram, or subscribe to our free podcast of the show. A production of UMKC's New Letters Magazine, today's show was produced with Ross Steinmetz, Stephanie Hughes, and Jamie Walsh. I'm Angela Elam. Thanks for listening to New Letters on the Air.